Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Alexander Strick von Linschoten, a graduate of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, as well as the author of An Enemy We Created, The Myth of the Taliban-Al-Qaeda Merger, 1970 to 2010, and most recently, the critically acclaimed Poetry of the Taliban, A History of the Relationship Between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. He is also the co-editor of a book written by former Taliban envoy to Pakistan, Mullah Abdul Salam Zaif, called My Life with the Taliban. Mr. Linschoten's appearance was co-sponsored by the Creighton University Casper Professorship in History. His topic will be Inside the Afghan Taliban, Politics, Poetry, and the Future of Afghanistan. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, September 24, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is John Calvert, the holder of the Henry W. Casper S.J. Associate Professorship in History in the Creighton University Department of History.
Alex lived in Kandahar for several years, and he frequently travels to Afghanistan and Pakistan for extended visits. In 2006, together with his colleague Felix Kuhn, he founded AfghanWire.com, which is an informational database dealing with issues related to Afghanistan. Alex is co-author with Felix Kuhn of three books, a memoir of Mullah Abdul Salam Zaif entitled My Life with the Taliban, An Enemy We Created, The Myth of the Taliban-Al-Qaeda Merger, and the critically acclaimed Poetry of the Taliban. Alex told me over lunch this afternoon that he's soon to begin work on a massive project translating primary sources relating to the Afghan Taliban. And all of these efforts are made possible by the fact that Alex speaks and reads Arabic, Farsi, Pashto, and German, and he can get by in French and Dutch. Well, we're really fortunate in having with us one of the world's leading authorities on the Taliban. So please join me in welcoming to Creighton Alex Strick von Linschoten.
Thank you, John. Just wanted to do a kind of quick straw poll before I started. Could you put your hands up if you're interested in Afghanistan? Should be everyone. Okay, keep your hands up, keep your hands up. You can put your hands down if you've never read a statement or a book written by the Taliban. Okay, that's more or less everyone. What I want to talk about today is the value of trying to see things through other people's eyes in the words or images that they choose to express themselves. And I argue it's not just simply a point of a point for academics to enjoy reading the intricate thoughts of groups like the Taliban just for themselves. I actually believe that by not trying to understand things through the eyes of groups like the Taliban, we miss opportunities to interact with them, to engage with them, and to possibly achieve the things that we want to in places like Afghanistan. My own personal background, as Professor Calvert alluded to earlier, I first came to Afghanistan as a tourist, essentially, back in 2004. I was studying Arabic and Farsi at university in London, and I would go to Afghanistan on my holidays and just travel around the country, essentially, studying the language, meeting people. Back then, the security situation was relatively good, and you could go most places. So I spent essentially 2 years doing that while I was studying languages back in London. And it was during that time that I kind of became interested in the missing voices from conversations. So, there was all of these policy debates in Washington, in Europe, about, what Afghans want, what Afghans think, But always missing from these policy debates were Afghan voices. What were Afghans talking about? You never really had any sense of what was being written in Afghan newspapers, for example, or what was being discussed on Afghan radio. But around that time, I set up a project called Afghan Wire, where we were translating and monitoring various media outlets in Afghanistan from around the country. And I was starting also to travel more and more in southern Afghanistan, where most of the kind of recent surge troops went, or they've left now, but when they went in 2009. And always during these travels, I would be forced to imagine myself into the heads of the people that I met. Perhaps in situations like this, where you would be sitting down with a number of people, at the beginning I didn't really speak any Pashto, so I was just trying to imagine, what does this person think? What does this person think about me? What does this person think about their own situation? What does he think about the government? During this, I was confronted by things essentially that I didn't understand. And it happened on the other side as well. When I live in southern Afghanistan, I live with Afghan friends. I don't really know any foreigners down there. So the experience that I have, let's say, of an American soldier in southern Afghanistan is broadly similar to that of an Afghan. It's some guy driving by in a Humvee or something, pointing a gun at you, more or less. And to a lot of Afghans, foreign soldiers in places like southern Afghanistan, they come across as aliens, more or less. It's some guy wearing goggles and strange clothes, and with a helmet on, doesn't speak your language. I had a very interesting experience watching a documentary produced in southern Afghanistan together with some of my friends, and it was one of these documentaries where they go around following some British soldiers in Helmand province, following their activities, what they're doing, fighting back at base, and so on, and then spend some time with their families back in the UK as well before their deployment and so on. And the most interesting thing that my Afghan friends found were there was one particular soldier who got killed during his deployment. Then afterwards, the camera crew came back and spoke to the mother, and the mother was obviously distraught and grieving for her loss. And when this episode finished, my Afghan friends, they wanted to talk to me, and said, "We never really thought that these people had mothers. This is this was almost a revelation for them that they hadn't really thought about things from the foreign soldier's perspective as well." So I would argue it goes both ways. It's not just that we don't understand groups like the Taliban, but also groups like the Taliban don't particularly understand us. All of this is perhaps by way of introduction. I started working together with this man, Mullah Abdussalam Zaif, in 2006, 2007, helping him to write his biography. He was quite a prominent figure within the Taliban movement throughout the 80s and the 90s, and particularly in 2001, as I'll come to talk about. I just wanted to kind of go through some key moments in his life story just to give you a kind of outline of this individual voice from within the Taliban movement to give a sense of the narrative that he's... he wrote in his book, and then also just to kind of talk a bit about why it's relevant to more than just his story. The key moment in many ways for the identity of a lot of these old generation Taliban fighters, so all of the kind of senior leadership we have at the moment, Mullah Omar and a number of other names, all of these people fought together during the 1980s against the Soviet Union in places like southern Afghanistan. Mullah Zaif, the person whose biography this was, he also fought He was quite young at the time. He was born in 1968, so he only fought for the last kind of 5 years of the war. But it's difficult to overstate the intensity of the fight that went on in southern Afghanistan. It's often forgotten, I think. The Taliban groups that were there, they were quite different from the other fighting groups. They insisted that the people who joined up and fought together with them would also study when they weren't fighting. They insisted that they, you know, progressed in their Islamic studies while they were on the battlefield. Most of the other groups that were fighting didn't insist on this and weren't so pious in a way. And the Taliban developed a kind of reputation of being these kind of rather boring, kind of bookish group among the fighters of that time. The intensity of the fight, in fact, was pretty important because it's created these incredibly strong bonds between these people who fought together on the front lines. One of the interesting things about this core leadership network at the moment is that I can't really think of a single instance where someone has come out in public and denounced Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, as, you know, not representing the leadership, or they've stuck together, and it's an incredibly loyal group, and the networks that extend from this 1980s, so other people who they fought with and so on, it's absolutely crucial to understanding how they operate now. Of course, there's a new generation of fighters, which adds a kind of complication to things, but for this old generation, the 1980s war was absolutely crucial. By 1994, Kandahar and southern Afghanistan had kind of degraded and collapsed into a state of civil war and anarchy. There were dozens of different groups, each manning little checkpoints along the roads. And while a lot of the people who'd been fighting together during the 1980s of these Taliban groups that I was talking about, while a lot of them had gone home, they were either studying in mosques, some of them had gone to Pakistan to start businesses. Around 1994, some of them started coming together and discussing among themselves, you know, what could be done about this situation. Maybe this was something that they could get back together and try and deal with the lawlessness and anarchy in their areas. And again, it's another thing which we often forget when we talk about this founding moment of the Taliban in 1994. They spent months and months and months talking about what the movement would be about, what its goals were, who would lead it. There were long kind of leadership discussions and short lists of candidates. Eventually, they decided on Mullah Muhammad Omar because he was a relatively uncontroversial candidate. He didn't have a particularly strong reputation for himself from the 1980s, but in many ways that was good because that meant he wasn't biased, or he wouldn't come down against one faction more than any other. So they all met in this building called the White Mosque, which still exists. And they took an oath and they swore their allegiance to Mullah Omar, and they said, "We will stick together with you no matter what, and we'll stay together to the end." And this was an incredibly important promise, again, and something that Mullah Omar would continue to extract continue to expect people to live up to, as he still does. And I think that's also partly responsible for this strong loyalty bond among the senior leaders. By 1998, the Taliban had expanded into all sorts of different corners of Afghanistan, into the west, into Herat, also up to the north, although they were having some problems taking the rest of the country in that way. And Mullah Zaif was working he did a variety of jobs. He worked for a time in the Ministry of the Banking Sector. He did a little stint in the Ministry of Mines and Industries, talking about, you know, the oil deals and the pipeline deals and so on, which various companies were trying to install in the country. Every so often, though, he would quit his job and he would go back to his village because either he didn't like that, enjoy that particular work, or he was having problems with whoever he was working with. But again, time and time again, Mullah Omar would call to him and say, you know, you have to come back, you have to work in so-and-so ministry. You would have to, in this example, you have to work in the Ministry of Defense. And he would say, you know, if you don't obey me, I'm going to lock you up, I'm going to put you in prison. So he ended up coming back to Kabul, and he was working as the acting administrator of defense for a little while, and then kind of an administrative director. And the account that he gives in his book is of the kind of inside the Taliban's bureaucracy is one of disintegration, one of essentially a movement that didn't really understand how to rule a country. They were using the old structures from previous governments to try and keep things running somewhat. But, you know, there was a lot of corruption. Some people were using their positions to act on feuds against other people. And Mullah Zaif at this time was asked to compile a list of people who'd been awarded medals of honor during the Soviet war for fighting against against the Afghan, who were fighting together with the Soviet Union, that is. So essentially this was to put together a list of people who would be imprisoned, some of whom may have been executed. And he resigned over this again. He went home to his house in Kandahar, and once again Mullah Omar came to him and said, you know, you have to come back. Eventually he came back, and he was working in some civilian ministries as well. And his next appointment was as the minister, the Taliban's minister to ambassador to Pakistan. And he found out about this while he was traveling in the car on the radio, which again is another indication of how the kind of Taliban's bureaucracy and government worked. This was essentially the government was in the hands of one person, was in the hands of Mullah Omar, and everything else was. You know, it was allowed to function as long as it didn't get in the way of his personal wishes. So by 2001, he was in Islamabad, in Pakistan, working as the Taliban's ambassador there. And this was the moment, of course, where on 9/11, he was kind of the public face of the movement, and he would hold these daily press conferences in Islamabad, which maybe some of you remember his face from at the time, and you know he was having to deal with all of these questions and discussions in the few months between the 9/11 attacks and the fall of the Taliban movement in December. The Taliban had tried to deal with the issue of Osama bin Laden several times during the 1990s, and I'm not going to talk too much about that. During my presentation, but perhaps we can talk about that in the questions afterwards. But essentially, they tried to offer various ways to get bin Laden out of the country in a way which would be which would look okay to the rest of the Islamic countries that they were trying to project. You know, that they were a good Muslim country. Mullah Omar particularly was worried that if they simply expelled bin Laden from the country during the 1990s, that it would look bad somehow, that, you know, other Muslim countries would think that he'd betrayed the cause of Islam or something like this. So they wanted some kind of fig leaf to be able to force him out of the country, but under an Islamic basis, so some kind of Islamic judgment from Saudi Arabia or some other countries which would allow him to say, okay, where Osama bin Laden is leaving the country, but it's, you know, for Islamic reasons, and so you can look at these respected scholars who've also agreed on this. None of these discussions, of course, came to anything really, in part because of miscommunication problems between the US and various countries that tried to talk to the Taliban on these issues. And of course, after 9/11, all of that ended more or less. Those discussions were over, and the Taliban were isolated as a movement. He spent over 4 years in detention from 2002 to 2005, you know, first he was on a battleship somewhere in the Indian Ocean. Then he was being held in Afghanistan And then he ended up in Guantanamo. He was one of the first plane loads of detainees to get flown over there. His release, in fact, was quite interesting. He was cleared for release after a few years, after he'd had some interrogation. And he was told, you know, the Afghan government is working to get you out of here. And he told some of his other prisoners that, you know, I think I'll be released soon. They all laughed at him. They said, no, you're going to be stuck in Guantanamo for the rest of your life. Finally, it appeared that actually he was going to get released. But on the day of his release, when the Red Cross came to kind of transfer him out of the prison, his prison guards came with a statement and told him to sign it. And the statement said, you know, I admit to having been involved in so-and-so incidents, and, you know, I was together with Al-Qaeda and I was involved in various terrorist activities, and I promise I will never do these again. He refused to sign it in the end, saying, you know, I am a Talib, I was a Talib, and I always will be a Talib, but I was never part of Al-Qaeda. In the end, he wasn't required to sign the letter, and he got released. Went back to Afghanistan, to Kabul, where he started writing various books. When I met him for the first time, in 2006, he'd written 8 books, I think, since his release. He was, in fact, released on September 11th, 2005. And his experience in detention in Guantanamo and these various other places has very much influenced how he views foreign governments, I think, how his sense of mistrust, and, you know, that the various foreign organizations that he was exposed to weren't interested in talking to him seriously about things, that they had other agendas. So Mullah Zaif, in some ways, is a kind of everyman for Afghanistan. He lived through all of these really key periods during Afghanistan's recent history, the 1980s war. He was involved in the Taliban movement. He was imprisoned post 9/11 in Guantanamo. Also, you know, his experience, which I didn't talk about, but growing up as a poor village kid in the 1970s. You know, it really represents a lot of different stories that one hears traveling around in southern Afghanistan. Yet, you know, it's relatively unique. I'm always struck traveling around at all of the different people who've never told their stories, who have equally interesting stories. Involving the 1980s war or their experiences during the Taliban government, and, you know, you'll talk to them, you'll interview them, you'll try and get it down on paper, and they say, well, this is the first time I'm ever telling anyone this story. I think there's a real need to try and collect and preserve these kinds of stories, in part to understand where Afghans are coming from, and where not just people from the Taliban like Mullah Zaif, but various people who might intersect with the Taliban in some ways, or in general, just to understand the kind of broader Afghan society. I think too often we neglect these kinds of stories for things that fit into our preconceptions of what Afghanistan is like, of how what happened during the history. It was around the time that I was working together with Mullah Zaif that I started hearing about these Taliban songs and Taliban poems. I was just browsing on the Taliban's website, and they have this this little section saying, you know, songs and poetry. And I thought, this is interesting. This wasn't really something that I expected or really associated with the Taliban, that these guys would also be writing poems. But as I came to discover, in fact, it's actually quite an important part of their sense of identity the kind of cultural aspect of who they are. You know, we often assume that groups like the Taliban are purely religious groups, and I think the religious element is often overstated. Things like the poems bind them together far more than religious doctrine or ideology in many ways. So this is, you know, essentially one of these websites where you can go and you download the files as MP3s. They often have like the lyrics or the words of these songs as well up on the site. But most people, because so many people in Afghanistan are illiterate, they just listen to them on their cell phones. And you know, you pull any kid off the street in southern Afghanistan, you look at their phone, they'll have some of these songs on their phones. What I wanted to do is just kind of give you a brief overview of some of the themes that that came up in this collection of 250 poems, and read out a few of them to you to give a sense of the flavor. There were some of them which were from before September 11th, from when the Taliban movement were actually in power. Before 9/11, the poems were, broadly speaking, kind of inwardly directed. But there's an interesting couple of poems which give you a sense of some of the kind of conflict within the movement. So we have one poem which is directed at the foreigners. There weren't any foreigners really in Afghanistan during the late 1990s, but talking about, you know, what other countries were saying about the Taliban government. They will ride the white horses in the red field, then we will install the white banner on the Kremlin's chest. The day of red blood will become red with the red's blood. The knife that is stuck into the Chechen's chest today, my enemy, go and read the history of heroism. There is a page written about McNaughton's chest. The pharaoh of the time sends arrows everywhere. These arrows will finally strike Washington's chest. So again, this is a kind of fairly belligerent poem speaking out against Washington, against Russia, against all sorts of things. And then you also have the preeminent kind of Taliban poet of the time, Abdul Basir Ebrat, writing a few years earlier a poem which was pretty conciliatory in comparison. So he writes, "Now we look at you with hopeful eyes. We are begging before you. Why did you become like Pharaoh? Why are you concealing your nose? Why don't any emotions come to your heart? This is essential for human beings. O enemy of ancient humanity, this is one of your moral duties. Either go away from me, leave me to my business in order to build my country by myself, or come close to me and honestly become my friend and put out the years-old fire within me." So again, two completely contrasting or opposite opinions within the same movement during the 1990s. We also have a section of love and pastoral poems. In fact, the Taliban are part of, when they have these poems, they're part of a much longer Pashto poetry tradition going back hundreds of years, to which they're just feeding into this, really. It's not like they invented all of the different genres or ways of writing these poems. In fact, if you go and look back at poems written by religious students during the 19th century, talking about, you know, the wars against the British during that time, if you read them and the ones which are being written today, actually there's not that much difference in terms of a lot of the themes being talked about. So there are a lot of love poems, poems about gardens, poems about nature. All of these are very standard things in Pashto poetry, in the tradition. There's one of them called Soul. "The village seems strange. This is separation, as if my beloved has left it. The grief of separation is so cruel that it is not scared of anyone. When the soul does not leave the body, it shakes, like a flower withering in the autumn. Autumn has now come to my love. I remain alone with my shaggy head of hair. Uncomprehending, my heart has been sad for a long time. In a flash, it put a hole in my entire world. Each affair is like an arrow. O Fakir, better be sad. Who told you that love is easy?" There are some religious poems in the collection, actually, there aren't very many at all. And again, this perhaps seems surprising, but I think, as I said before, I think we often overstate the importance of religion in a kind of overt sense to groups like the Taliban. In fact, things like love poems, things like what I'm going to talk about in a minute, these are much more important than theological debates, than poems about meditations on particular points of doctrine and so on. In the religious section, you know, we have some prayers. There's a meditation on the creation story. There's some comments on the religiosity of other people. So, you know, there's someone arguing that people aren't praying enough and so on, and why is this person behaving like this? There are some written for special religious occasions, for Ramadan, the month of fasting, for Eid, the celebration that comes afterwards. And there are some kind of Talibanized readings of some stories from the Quran, which also come out in the, which are also, you know, from the Bible as well. So Abraham and Potiphar and this whole story, there's a poem about that and kind of imagining of that. But again, it's out of 250 poems, we're talking about 10 or 15 poems. It's not that much, really. There's quite a lot which is essentially discontent, we called it, which is not specifically related to the conflict. This is political and social dis-ease and discontent with their situation. There are some poets who try and think about what it means to be a writer in society where everything is in conflict. We have some poems about women and what the role of women in society is. We have some poems about, you know, the NGOs, which the non-governmental organizations which were founded in the post-2001 kind of government. There's a kind of satire about how many NGOs there are, and they're all overpaid, and there's all of these people coming in from other countries. So all of these things are there, but there isn't actually that much about the Afghan government or about President Karzai or about the Afghan security forces. Hardly any of that at all, in fact, which was a bit surprising to me. There's a lot about corruption and justice here, and a sense that, you know, the country is being ruled by people who have no sense of the good of the country and who are immoral, essentially. The section we call the trench is all of the things that you'd expect from Taliban poets, right? So it's kind of motivational war chants, it's ballads about what it feels like to fire a machine gun, you know, what it feels like fighting while being bombed, all of these kinds of things. There's quite a lot of these, and this is the kind of the more overt propaganda element of the poems. The interesting thing is about the composition of the poems is this is the only output of the Taliban, the kind of written things which don't pass through some kind of censorship committee, essentially. So when they put out a press release or something like this, then it needs to be approved by the central leadership, essentially, the spokesperson. The poems, you know, you can be a university student or you can be just a fighter and you'll email it or you'll give it to someone and your poem will go up on the website. So this is more or less the only place where you can go to find a kind of uncensored views from within the Taliban, aside from going to talk to them, which of course is also possible. So you have a poem called "Goodbye," where a fighter says farewell to his families. "Allow me to go and say goodbye to you, dear mother. I won't stay any more. Goodbye. Englishmen have occupied my home. By no means I cannot stay any more. They play with our dignity and chastity. I shy with my conscience. It would be better at this moment to go to the fight." We also have in this section a poem written by a woman, in fact, and it's kind of a different take on these kind of invocations to go into war. She's saying, you know, the men are lazy, essentially, and she needs to be the one to go into the fight. So she writes, "Give me your turban and take my veil. Give me the sword so that the matter will be dealt with. You stay at home, I am going to the battlefield. I will either free my dear land or we will make a new Karbala. Don't just call yourselves men. How long will you lie there asleep? You sit among the girls. May calamity fall down upon your masculinity. Again, so this isn't something that you would really expect from, you know, to appear on the Taliban website as, you know, poetry. Again, offering a different perspective, offering an alternative view, offering something which in many ways is much more real than the kinds of things that we read in our newspapers. Lots of other poems about the battle. There are some places where the poet imagines what his opposite number is, what the enemy is like. And here you have a lot of the kind of the misunderstandings that we have of the Taliban, you have replicated from the other direction. There's one poem in which the Talib fighter imagines himself stalking through the woods as a deer, and the American soldier trying to kill him is the hunter. And it's this kind of game between the two, which again I think is not an image that we would we think of really when we think of the Afghan war and the conflict, this kind of the deer and the hunted, which I think these kinds of images bring us closer in many ways to their experience of the conflict. And then finally we have a section called The Human Cost, where there's a lot about essentially the civilian cost of war, under whether it's bombardment or prisons or torture or descriptions of essentially the suffering of war, and there's a lot of these, and this is one of the reasons why the poems are so successful and popular in a way in Afghanistan. Even people who aren't formally affiliated with the Taliban, they'll also have these poems and songs on their phones. You know, I have friends who work in the government, kind of provincial council, and they'll say, well, you know, I don't support the Taliban, and obviously I'm working together with the government, so this puts me in opposition to them. But when I hear these poems, it says something to me. It says something to my heart, which, again, I think is something that we often forget, this kind of crossover of feeling in a way between the movement and the kind of the general population. I'll just give one example of these poems, which is the story of a widow going to the graveyard every day in the evening to visit a particular grave. Every day when evening comes and when the redness appears in the sky, there is a mourning near this grave, and the sky just watches it. A woman with a black veil comes to this grave and sits near its tomb, and then gradually starts crying. What words of silent prayer she speaks to herself. She cries as if unconscious, and then she takes a nice handkerchief and wraps it around the flag and starts walking home. She is even ready to give her life for him. That's her whole life. She lives in grief. I don't know what's wrong with her, but her youth is turning to soil. As I see these incidents, my heart splits into pieces. With the situation of these poor widows, my life becomes grief. What cruelty is it that has brought this grief to our nation? Lights are snuffed on contact. There is great grief and darkness. So after this book came out, there was a number of media articles and so on, and somewhat of a kind of controversy, at least in the UK. There was a little bit of this in the US as well. When we put together this book, we weren't really expecting these kinds of comments or this kind of very strong reaction. But in fact, the debate and the discussion over the book was pretty interesting in kind of illuminating some of the ways that we think about the Taliban, some of the ways that the Taliban are portrayed in the media, some of the ways that the Taliban try and sell themselves. And it was, these different narratives, it became very clear that there were, a number of different strands to understanding who the Taliban were, and that we all seem to have a different view and a different sense of who they were. So it was interesting to watch this debate. In general, from the poems, what comes out isn't so much a sense of, you know, that there is one ideology of the movement, that there is one view, that there's this, you know, quite a big diversity of opinion. There's one poem where in fact a poem says, you know, looks around at the country and looks around at the kind of the dust and the destruction. He says, we did all of this to ourselves. So there's kind of elements of self-reflection there in between the lines. In many ways, this allows this kind of fragmented vision and kind of cultural identity to the Taliban is one of the things that allows all sorts of different people to tag along to the movement without necessarily being affiliated with them. It's one of the things which gives them some level of tacit or understood appeal in many ways. And there is, you know, there are several generations involved in writing these poems. We have people from that original 1980s generation that Mullah Zaif represents, and we also have some of the younger poets as well, who are contributing from university, maybe, but who wanted to put something up on the Taliban's website. Why does all of this matter? I think particularly now, the need to try and understand things through other people's eyes is pretty important. It's not just a question of Afghanistan, of course. We have in the Middle East a lot going on. We have, you know, in the Horn of Africa, in throughout South Asia, there are all sorts of these issues that are brought up through these examples that I was just using from Afghanistan, where you know, misunderstandings will be our downfall in many ways. You know, it's not so much that there aren't ways to solve problems or ways to engage with people. It's more that if we fail to try and see things through other perspectives, through other people's eyes, then we'll miss opportunities to either solve the problems that exist, or possibly, you know, get the things that we want in certain places. As I said, it works both ways, of course. I would argue that the Taliban are just as bad at understanding us and who we are and what our intentions are. You know, you talk to any of them and there'll be a whole host of kind of conspiracy theories that will come out about how America wants to, you know, stay in Afghanistan forever because, you know, it's the first front against China and all sorts of things like this. And, you know, maybe we can talk in the questions about this kind of very fine line between empathy and sympathy. So, you know, it's to put yourselves in someone else's shoes, to imagine things through their eyes, it can be, you know, a fairly daunting step for many. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to agree with whatever is going on, but I think it helps you to understand and appreciate the situation in a far more real sense than you would get just by kind of falling into the stereotype of groups like the Taliban and others. That's kind of all I had to say. Thank you very much. And if there are any questions...
How much support do the Taliban have amongst the general Afghan population? And as a follow-up, once the Americans pull out, are they unalterably opposed to the Afghan government? And will they, you know, seek to defeat them? Or will they try to negotiate with the government?
In terms of the support, I think obviously it's different in different places, right? So Afghanistan's a pretty big country, and different parts of Afghanistan have had experienced the foreign presence in different ways. If you go up in the north, they haven't really experienced the kind of militarized foreign presence in the way that people in the South have. So in the North, the Taliban don't have a great deal of support, also because they're from different ethnic groups. Well, that's a slightly simplified way of putting it. In the South, it's a bit difficult, you know, because you'll have you have a kind of split consciousness in many ways. So people will say, on the one hand, you know, I don't like the way the Americans are behaving in our country. I don't like the way they, you know, barge into our house and conduct a night raid or something like this. But then you say, okay, the Americans will go. And they say, no, I don't want the Americans to go because actually everything will fall apart if they go. And people are perfectly happy to have those two positions simultaneously, depending on, you know, what particular part of the day you catch them on or what specifically happened to them in their life. In general, I think it's become... they don't have... I mean, there are different levels of support as well. You know, there's the level where you'll actually go and spend time and you'll fight together with them. There's the level where perhaps you will give them food if they pass through your village. There's a level where, you know, you won't... You won't inform on them to American forces in your area. And there's this kind of more kind of cultural level where people will engage with the Taliban in the poems and things like this, but they won't approve of attacks necessarily or things like this. Broadly speaking, I think the kind of active support for the Taliban has been going down and down and down in recent years because people are sick of the war. The number of civilian casualties that are caused and so on, and the Taliban conduct a lot of attacks where there'll be a suicide bomber near a school or something like this. So particularly in the South, people are pretty fed up of this kind of thing. Yet at the same time, they also see the Afghan government as kind of predatory and corrupt, and you know, every time you need to get anything done, you have to pay a bribe or this kind of thing. So, you know, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. They don't necessarily have anything to choose. The Taliban are people they know or knew since they were younger. The government, they're not really sure. You know, foreign troops are leaving. So it fluctuates, and probably the support is not so high. In terms of what happens after American troops pull out, I mean, well, to start with, you know, there'll always be, for at least, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, there'll be, you know, 15, 20,000 foreign troops in Afghanistan for a long time, I think, even if they're just kept in bases and so on, for, you know, drone attacks on Pakistan or just keeping Afghanistan and holding the kind of government together and defending the cities. In general, I don't think it's going to be the kind of... You often read these kind of apocalyptic scenarios where, you know, on January 1st, 2015, everything will fall apart. There'll be instant civil war. I don't really think it would turn out that way, in part because no one wants that to happen. Even from the Taliban perspective, when I talk to their fighters or to their leaders, they'll say, well, you know, civil war is the last thing that we want, and you know, we kind of see it as our responsibility to try and prevent that from happening. That said, I don't think many of them believe that they can win the war outright. You know, they can continue fighting forever, essentially. You know, they can keep supplying their ranks, and they can continue this kind of low-level guerrilla campaign. But in terms of taking Kabul, taking the whole country again, like they did in the 1990s, when people are talking seriously, then they'll say, well, actually, no, we can't do that. And also since 2001, they've had a lot of time to think about their own government and the mistakes that they made. And a lot of them will say, well, you know, we had no idea how to rule this country. We completely messed it up. They will talk about the need to, you know, to find educated people to run the ministries because, you know, we're just village mullahs. You know, what do we know about this? The things that they're concerned about are the kind of moral life of the country. So they want, you know, input in things like education policy. They want to be involved in kind of legal stuff. That obviously, in the religious life of the country, they want an input in this. So there's a group and there's a current within the Taliban who's trying to kind of seek to stave this off by engaging in negotiations with the U.S., with the Afghan government. But of course, there are always kind of hardliners within the Taliban as well who just want to keep fighting as well, because it's good money.
Okay, let's get another question.
The poems that you presented seem to present a very sort of human range of emotions, but I don't get the sense that the Taliban think of themselves as sort of a, you know, citizen of the world. So can you talk a little bit more just about that self-identity? They clearly define an other, like the Russians and the Americans, but I didn't see a lot of words about Afghan or Afghanistan. And I know there's also like a Pakistani Taliban, and there's sort of a complicated relationship between the Afghanis and the Pakistanis and the Taliban. So could you just address that sense of, is it a national identity? And then how do they differentiate themselves from the Pakistanis, or what do they think of the Pakistanis?
Thanks. In fact, just in terms of the Pakistani Taliban, they have also their own kind of poetry output as well, except the way the Pakistanis run it, it's much more like a kind of propaganda factory, and they'll have, you know, 10 guys sitting in a room writing poems, recording them, putting them out. They'll get paid a salary. They're putting out specific messages that they want to influence kind of young kids and stuff. It's very much a kind of propaganda outfit, which the Afghan Taliban don't really have. The point about everything being kind of fragmented and complicated is kind of the answer to that, to your question, in that there's a broad vein of kind of nationalism to all of these all of the people who are writing the poems. There's a kind of pride in their country, a pride in local custom and tradition. There's a pride in the kind of their religion, but religion is kind of seen in a kind of cultural sense. It's part of it's what they grew up with, rather than something that they studied or ideologically that they're interested in discussing. But part of the problem with the Taliban is that it's so disparate and kind of diffuse in a way. And especially with Mullah Omar essentially living in hiding, there's nothing essentially which unites it. And more and more, the longer the kind of conflict continues, the more you have a younger, newer generation of fighters essentially who didn't grow up in these kind of old values of nationalism. They've never lived in a country that was at peace. So they're far less interested in trying to return to something, in trying to return to, you know, an Afghanistan at peace, and they're a lot more kind of ideological in their motivations than the older generation.
I noticed in your talk you seem to make a lot of references to the Taliban. Kind of as a very self-conscious organization, like, you know, taking actions, you know, in the view of other Islamist groups or the international media or the West, you know, taking actions because of how they would be, you know, viewed by a certain group of people. Like, how successful do you think the Taliban has been in kind of mythologizing itself, you know, in the steps that it's taken and, you know, the poems and, you know, do you think that's kind of its mission? And if so, how successful have they been at it?
Not very successful. I mean, it depends who you're talking about. Like, I mean, if you're talking about among Afghans, that's a different thing. If you're talking in the West, I mean, when you say public relations to man or woman on the street, they'll think about the images that you were talking about, the destruction of the Buddhas, the treatment of the women, and so on. And they haven't really put out books or messages in a way attempting, you know, they were particularly smart in terms of how they portrayed themselves. You know, you go on the website and you read some of their statements, and it'll just be a very kind of angry denunciation of anyone who doesn't agree with them. And in fact, I mean, the book of poems and the the autobiography of Mullah Zaif are more or less the only things which are available in English from the Taliban, which offer a more kind of complicated or less kind of angry engagement with some of this kind of reputation. They're really concerned about it nowadays, and this new education policy, for example, which sounds really nice, this was in part an attempt to portray themselves to the world as an organization that's changed, that isn't, you know, the same as they were during the 1990s. They're participating more and more in, you know, polio vaccination campaigns. They're involved in these kind of small healthcare initiatives. So they try and do this through actions more rather than statements these days, in part because no one believes their statements. So they feel the need to kind of have something to show for this change. But no, they haven't been particularly successful.
I was just wondering, like, how has your relationship been with, like, the U.S. government in procuring these documents? Like, have they labeled you as hostile or, like, labeled you as a terrorist for engaging or promoting their way of life? I was curious about that.
Well, I had a very friendly chat with the secondary security on entering U.S. airspace for 3 or 4 hours the other day. No, I mean, I with my work, I engage from time to time with U.S. kind of people from the State Department or the military or whatever, to talk about, you know, these kind of local perspectives and Taliban perspectives, because I think it's important for them to hear these kind of different voices. So to some extent, I'm known through that way, and you know, these books are read by people in the U.S. military and otherwise. So while people don't necessarily you know, support what it is or the books themselves, they see the value in it and they find it useful for their kind of ongoing work. So yeah, I mean that's kind of the state.
Thank you so much for coming. I think we've all been enlightened by, again, one of the world's experts on the Taliban. This is an uncommon opportunity. So let's thank Alex for coming to Creighton.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Alexander Strick von Linschoten, a graduate of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, as well as the author of An Enemy We Created, The Myth of the Taliban-Al-Qaeda Merger, 1970-2010, and most recently, the critically acclaimed Poetry of the Taliban. He is also the co-editor of a book written by former Taliban envoy to Pakistan, Mullah Abdul Salam Zaif, called My Life with the Taliban, A History of the Relationship Between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Mr. Linschoten's appearance was co-sponsored by the Creighton University Casper Professorship in History. He spoke on the topic, Inside the Afghan Taliban, Politics, Poetry, and the Future of Afghanistan. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, September 24, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.